It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. More than 500 Wisconsin motorists were injured last year in collisions with deer. Four motorcyclists were killed. A state transportation official joins us to explain why June is a peak month for crashes involving deer and what drivers can do to stay safe. Have you noticed more deer on the roads this month? What have you been doing in response? Have you ever hit a deer with your car or truck or motorcycle in Wisconsin? What did you learn from that experience? Share your questions or comments with us by calling 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dave Pabst is director of the Bureau of Transportation Safety at the State Department of Transportation. Dave, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Car deer crashes. Wow, that's a fixture in Wisconsin for as long as I can remember. Where do most of these crashes with deer happen?
Well, it can happen anywhere. As far as the numbers go, Dane County, Waukesha County, and Washington County suffered the most in 2018. In Dane County alone, there were over 1,000 in 2018. And it just kind of shows you that even though Dane County is a mix of rural and city, that the deer are out there and are very, they are thriving, if you will, and people are running into them with their vehicles.
Well, and we get deer crashes in the cities as well. I mean, it stands to reason you have more drivers and the deer have moved in to more populated areas. So we're seeing deer crashes in the cities, not just out in the countryside.
That's correct. You'll see them anywhere, and it's, you know, you can drive along any street and possibly see a deer or a turkey and other animals. You know, wildlife is just flourishing here.
Why is June such a peak month for drivers hitting deer?
Well, vehicle miles traveled is increasing, but also the deer are dropping their baby deer and are, shooing the yearlings out, and so you've got inexperienced deer running around without their moms, and moms having more deer, so they're looking for places to have their babies, and a lot of extra activity and movement. So you combine the deer moving around and a lot extra traffic because of the summer months, you have a recipe for crashes.
And our driving habits change in the summer a little bit too, don't they?
Right. Our speeds tend to pick up and we just put on more miles. And one of the items we have to be really careful of is because deer will, step out at any time, at anywhere, but especially in the evening and in the morning when they're feeding and whatnot. But if we are distracted and not wearing our seatbelts, we're setting ourselves up to get hurt.
Well, we should always have our seatbelts on anytime we're in the car, and it's always important to do that. So let's hope people are doing that. But the distraction thing, that's something that's involved in a lot of crashes, not just car deer crashes. June is also planting season for a lot of farmers. Does that activity push more deer into the roads?
Well, any kind of activity along where they like to feed. Of course, deer are edge animals, so they like to be where there's woods for safety and an open clearing where they can get their food. And so I would imagine that is pushing the deer around as well. Just like in November, the hunters push the deer around.
Dave Pabst is from the State Department of Transportation. He's with us to talk about driver safety and avoiding deer on Wisconsin's roadways. If you have a quick question for our guest, 800-642-1234. You can also email us, ideas@wpr.org. So June is a peak time for vehicle collisions with deer. When else during the year should drivers be even more watchful for deer on the roads?
Of course, in the fall, October, November, and December, we see a huge peak as well because it's the rut and also the extra activity of the hunters in the woods. And so it's one of those real peak times as well. But people don't think about it during the summer. I'm not going to see a deer, but you do. And, of course, you mentioned earlier that people get hurt. And this is the time of the year when car deer crashes are the most violent and people get hurt the most during this period.
Well, when you think about it, I mean, the physics of this, a deer is a substantial animal. You hit that with your car at 70 miles an hour, there's going to be damage. And, and particularly if you're on a motorcycle, it's even more dangerous, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You don't have the protections you have in a car. At least in your car, you hit a deer, your airbag is probably going to go off and you have your seatbelt on and you have that steel shell around you protecting you. But a motorcyclist doesn't have that advantage. They need to be wearing all their gear, leather gear, gloves, helmet and whatnot to give them that edge if they do happen to come across a deer. And we always tell people, don't swerve if you're driving a car and you see a deer. Just apply the brakes and stop and scrub off as much speed as you can. But if you hit the deer, you hit the deer, then pull off to the side of the road and call 911. But if you're in a motorcyclist and you hit a deer, that can prove fatal. We had 4 fatalities last year of motorcyclists hitting deer. And so what they are instructed to do is swerve, but try to stay within their lane and try not to hit the deer because it's so tragic when they do.
Let's take a quick call from Jason, who's actually he's on the road. He's out at mile marker 288. Jason, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
I got a question here. Is it lawful for me to take a deer that I hit on the road and put it in my trunk and take it home, put it on the dinner table?
Well, what you have to do is you have to notify the DNR and you get a car kill permit so you can have that deer. But if you want a deer that's been hit by a car or that you hit, you're entitled to it. It's just you have to get a permit.
Jason, thanks for that call. So you said we should pull off the road and call 911. Should we try to move an injured deer off the road so other drivers don't hit it?
Certainly not. The safest place for you is in your vehicle, buckled up, so if you do get hit, you're protected as much as possible. But a wounded deer can be very dangerous. Their hooves are sharp, and they can thrash around, and it's best just not to do anything on the road. Let the professionals remove the deer.
How often are deer carcasses removed from the roads? We see them along the interstate and so forth. How does the state manage this?
Well, we have a program, a car-killed deer program or vehicle-killed deer program, and we make contracts with the counties and with private vendors that remove the carcasses. And one of the important things to do is remember to, if you see a carcass, call the county that you're in and advise them where it's at. Some people assume the other guy has called it in. So we just encourage everyone to call in a carcass that they see so that it can get removed or moved off to the side where we can't see it.
Let's review for people what people should do to avoid crashes. You said don't swerve, stay in your lane, hit the brakes. What other tips can you share? Even if you see a deer up ahead, what should you be doing?
Well, you see a deer, you should be slowing and assume that there's more than one. You have to apply the brake and come to a stop if you can do so safely. And like I say, if you see one deer, there's probably another one. And what you have to remember, too, deer and their hooves on concrete or on blacktop, it's like they're on ice. So they can't stop and start really well, and they're very unpredictable. So it's just so important to, stay in your lane and slow. But make sure that you have that edge by not being distracted by your radio or by a phone. Any other kind of distraction, because you need that extra millisecond to react. And so
and morning and evening are best times to see them. That's when they're the most active?
Generally, yes. And, of course, okay. That's when they're trying to find forage or finding a place to rest, and they are definitely more active then. So you have to certainly be on the lookout.
All right. Well, let's all be more careful out there. And as we always say, when people are leaving the house, watch for deer. Dave Pabst is Director of the Bureau of Transportation Safety at the State Department of Transportation. Dave, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Up next, we explore what trees have to say about Wisconsin's climate history and how scientists hope they could help inform our future. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent on The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Some of the best climate historians on the planet are trees. Due to the longevity of some species, scientists can gather information about past seasons, weather patterns, and regional climates from tree rings. We're exploring what Wisconsin's trees have to say about the state's climate history. Later on, we'll discuss how the changing climate is impacting certain tree species with cultural significance for tribal nations. Have you looked at tree rings? What did you see? What questions do you have about what they mean? What have you noticed about trees in your area? Have the forests been changing? Share your observations with us. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also join us via email, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Evan Larson is an associate professor of geography at UW-Platteville, specializing in dendrochronology, the use of tree rings to study environmental history and change. Evan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here.
Most people are familiar with the fact that tree rings show a tree's age, but we can also learn about the climate conditions the tree has experienced. Tell us about the science of dendroclimatology. Did I say that right?
You got it, yeah.
Okay. How long has that been around, and is it becoming more widely accepted?
Well, that's a great question. The science of dendrochronology has been something that it's one of these intuitive things where people look at a stump. There's a great quote by Leonardo da Vinci about looking at how ring width varies and how that relates to how much moisture those trees received that year. But as a science, it's really a phenomenon that's risen in the 1900s. In the early 1900s, A.E. Douglas is often talked about, at least in North America, as one of the fathers of dendrochronology. And he was an astronomer down in Arizona. And he was really interested in how sunspot cycles affected the Earth's weather and climate. And so he ended up looking at the growth rings of ponderosa pine from down in that region and trying to link it with precipitation and how energy from the sun kind of changes how much moisture is moving around in the atmosphere. And the science started as a really technical approach to understanding our world at that point, and it's grown incredibly since then.
What types of weather or climate patterns can be reflected in a tree ring? You mentioned sunspots and moisture. What is it that rings look like when they indicate certain conditions?
Sure, and this is partly what drew me into it, because it's a tangible thing. You're looking at these trees, and they can a lot of times just be really beautiful. With tree rings, it depends on the type of tree, and it depends where it's growing, and you can see how much rain fell. You can see if it was warm or cold, depending on the place and the tree. You can see if there were fires that passed by. You can see if there's competition from other trees around them. You can see everything from very local phenomenon up to windstorms, tornadoes, almost anything. And if you think about it, those trees are recording everything that's happening to them. And so I think where we're at with the science of dendrochronology is that we're really pushing to try and see more and more of the story that's recorded by every individual tree.
Tell us more about what a sunspot cycle is.
Oh, this is a little outside of my expertise, but what we have going on is generally you have an 11-year cycle of sunspot activity. It's related to solar output. And it's something that changes how much energy we receive here at the surface of the Earth. And that can have really important impacts on how our weather and climate work.
Let's get into what you've seen and learned from Wisconsin's tree species. Through your work at UW-Platteville, you've looked at trees in the Driftless region of southwestern Wisconsin. What did you find there?
A few years ago, when we really started doing a lot of work down there, we called it the Driftless Oaks Project, and we collected tree ring samples from about 400 oak trees growing across southwest Wisconsin. And the oaks that we were coring were between 200 to over 300 years old. And what we found is that their growth patterns are really tightly linked with how much moisture is available to them over the growing season.
And how can you tell what the temperatures were like, for example, by looking at tree rings? Can you tell if it was a cool summer or a hot summer, or when you look at a set of tree rings, you know, what jumps out? Oh, look at that summer must have been pretty cool.
Yeah. So With the oaks, we were looking very much at how much moisture was available. 1895 was incredibly dry, and every tree across our entire study area had a really, really narrow ring in there. Late 1700s, also, again, really dry, some drought in the mid-1800s. When you're talking about temperature, the oaks actually, they don't record temperature as well as other species. We're just wrapping up a project, some colleagues at UW-Platteville and some students and I, and we're calling it the Driftless Cedar. So it's related to the oaks project, but we're working with eastern red cedar from bluffy outcrops throughout the Driftless area. And the best record we found was at Devil's Lake State Park. And we've got eastern red cedar that go back to 1160 now. And, yeah, that's a long ways back. And
it's imagine a tree being that old in Wisconsin since we pretty much clear-cut everything in the 1890s. But what did the cedar tell you about the temperatures?
So the beauty about this field is that you have to go to the places that haven't been cut. And we can talk actually because there are other places that have been cut that you can still gather a tree ring record. And we're doing some great work in the Boundary Waters with stumps and around the Great Lakes. We're starting to look at historical structures as sources of samples. And later this summer, we're going to be working with timbers from submerged logs and deadheads from the logging area. But with the cedar, they're growing out on the Towel Slopes. For those of you who have been to Devil's Lake, you've probably seen these trees. They're twisted and gnarly. And if you look at where they're growing, there's almost no soil. And what we're interpreting that to mean is that as these trees are living, you know, if it rains, that's great. They'll get a little sip, but the water doesn't stay in those places. And so what we found with eastern red cedar in those conditions is that hot summers can really stress them out. It heats their foliage. It forces them to evaporate more water to kind of stay in their photosynthetic efficiency range. And what that means is that if it's really hot, eastern red cedar put on a really narrow ring. And sometimes they won't even put on a ring at all. And we can talk about cross-dating and the process of looking at how really extreme years can drive trees to do some pretty amazing things. And so with the cedar trees at Devil's Lake, we find narrow rings represent the hottest years and wider rings represent the cooler years.
Evan Larson is an associate professor of geography at UW-Platteville, specializing in dendrochronology, the use of tree rings to study environmental history and change. We've talked about oak trees. We've talked about cedar trees. What did you learn about drought in the Midwest through your study? Why was it noteworthy for this reason?
Sure. So people have been interested in drought for a long time. And there have been some really phenomenal researchers in the field of dendrochronology that have established networks of chronologies across the continent. And what we did was we looked at the fact that if you looked at the Driftless area, there were actually relatively few chronologies. And so a lot of the data that were available are from outside of that region. But for those of you who are familiar with the region, you know that it has really distinct geography. It has distinct soils and landforms. And so when we were able to develop local tree ring chronologies, we were able to really sharpen the history and better understand kind of what was happening within the Driftless area. And so the reconstruction we developed from that it tells more of an on-the-ground story for the Driftless area.
And you actually were able to use what you learned about climate through tree rings and compare it to agricultural yields. Break down very quickly for us how that worked.
Yeah. So with tree rings and looking at drought, how much moisture is obtained by that tree influences, you know, how wide the oaks could put on for their rings. When we looked at yields of corn and soy, what was interesting to look, there's this tremendous upward trend, and that's, you know, the result of improved technology and genetics and just farming techniques. And if you kind of take away that trend, if you look at the year-to-year variations, you know, good year, bad year, relative to that trend, what we found that over the last 70 years or so, that the relationship in that year-to-year variability is becoming more tightly and tightly linked with the relationship or with the year-to-year variability in oaks. And so it sure looks from the tree ring record, seeing how growth patterns are becoming increasingly similar to our interannual variability in yield, that we're kind of coming to that boundary where we're squeezing everything that we can out of this place, and our productivity could become more and more tightly linked with the weather.
Mm. We're going to take a look at the news in just a moment, and then our conversation continues about the information that trees can share with us if we will pay attention. Evan Larson is an associate professor of geography at UW-Platteville, specializing in dendrochronology, the use of tree rings to study environmental history and change. Have you looked at tree rings? What did you see? What questions do you have for Evan about the meaning of tree rings? Maybe you've noticed some tree species changing in your area. Tell us about that. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Later on, we're going to hear from a Wisconsin tribal leader about the cultural significance of certain tree species and how they're being affected here in Wisconsin. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. A tree's rings can tell us more than just its age. They can also tell us about weather patterns and past seasons. We're learning how to read these rings with Evan Larson. He's an associate professor of geography at UW-Platteville. He specializes in dendrochronology, the use of tree rings to study environmental history and change. Have you looked at tree rings? What did you see? What questions do you have? What have you noticed about trees in your area? Are you seeing certain species disappearing? Share your observations with us at 800-642-1234. Let's start by going to the phones. Gary joins us from Boscobel. Gary, good morning. Welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I worked in the state forestry tree nursery here in Boscobel for 29 years, and so one of my duties was to assess tree seed crops every year and determine collecting techniques and things like that. And I saw a lot of variable processes going on with the tree blooming and seed production. And it compelled me to pay attention to the forest. And if you look around now and you look at the forest as you're traveling, you can see a frightening amount of dead trees sticking up out of the canopies of our forest. And with the demise of our native quality species like elm and black, white, and green ash being killed by ash borers, and butternut, American butternut, just about gone, and other species that are just diminishing. I can see the potential of our forest converting from a desirable hardwood species to more undesirable species such as cherry and box elder and elm and other species that are not the same quality as what we've got now. And then with the increased deer population eating everything that's in our woodlands now, the reproduction on hardwood trees is also really being hammered. So, and then with climate change taking place, I'm really concerned that our forests are going to either degrade to really just brush patches or maybe not exist as any kind of quality ecosystem at all.
Gary, thanks for your comment. Evan, you want to comment on what Gary was saying?
Yeah, it can kind of feel like a grim situation sometimes when you start looking at everything that's going on out there. You know, there's golly, where do you want to start, Gary? we've seen tremendous changes, and what we're going through right now is really unprecedented in the history of a lot of these species, because we had an immense land use change 150 years ago across most of Wisconsin, and you know, with logging and agriculture and really ecological upheaval. So you have that major disturbance that started this whole process, because then you have the forest that's reestablishing, but it's also reestablishing in the presence of invasive species, shifting land use, and changing climate conditions. And so that's a lot of variability for species to cope with. At the same time, you have a transition away from fire as a really important process on the landscape. And so species like oaks and oaks down south and pines up north, they're also kind of losing what you could almost think of as an ally in terms of their regeneration dynamics. And so I think that across the state, you're seeing a lot of different things happening that are coalescing to this point where we're at a really important and dramatic point of change in Wisconsin's forests.
And have you noticed the warming of the climate making it more hospitable here for pests and insects that damage the trees?
Well, I mean, I'm really curious to see what this winter did to emerald ash borer, but it's certainly a factor. And what's interesting is if you look at climate change projections and what we've seen so far, it's winter temperatures that are changing a lot. And that's really important for impacting pest populations and insect populations and things like that. But you also we've done some work with eastern hemlock up in the northern part of the state along the south shore of Lake Superior and on the Apostles. And what we see with those is that kind of similar to the cedar, but hot summers actually stress them out where – if it's too hot, they end up using a lot of their energy and resources to kind of cope with that stress. And then the next year, they actually put on a really narrow ring. And so, 2012 was right around the time where we started doing that work. And if people remember, that was a really hot, dry year in a lot of places. And, you see a lot of dieback in the crowns of hemlock that were impacted by that. You can see it in the pines at Devil's Lake. You can see kind of this impact from a really severe event that then kind of ripples through that forest for years to come.
Mm-hmm. When to study trees' rings, do you have to cut down the tree?
Oh, that's a question we get a lot. The answer is no. There's a tool called an increment bore, and it's basically the same design that was created by a German forester back in the 1800s. It's like a hollow drill bit. And so you can turn this in by hand, and if you do it right, you'll go from the bark to the very center of that tree, and then you can take out what's basically a dowel, like a piece of wood about the diameter of a pencil, and it'll have every ring in that tree's life that kind of goes back, and you can use that to tell the story. We do a lot of work with deadwood as well. We've worked in the Boundary Waters in Quetico, a great research group and looking at patterns of fire as they relate to Anishinaabe land tenure and land use. And so in that case, working in wilderness, we are not allowed to cut trees. And you can use stumps and look at these patterns of growth that change from year to year and think about them almost like a fingerprint. And by doing that, you can compare the growth patterns in samples from dead trees to the patterns that you see in your core samples from living trees, and then you can connect that and extend your record further and further back in time.
You alluded to this earlier, but you can actually study tree rings through wood that's been repurposed, like a log cabin or something like that?
Yeah, there's a huge realm of dendrochronology. You could call it dendroarchaeology. There's a lot of people that have worked this in Europe and across the western U.S. and the southeast U.S., increasingly in the Mediterranean region, where people are really parsing out kind of human history over thousands of years by looking at tree rings that are incorporated into the structures that people built. Here in the Great Lakes, a couple summers ago, a colleague from the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey and I went and found some old pilings from a pier that was built in 1871 in the mouth of the Kalamazoo River. And we're able to find tree ring data that goes back to the 1600s for an area that had been logged really heavily. And so the living trees weren't there, but those structures kind of carry that record. And that's where we can get this climate information.
Evan Larson is an associate professor of geography at UW-Platteville. He specializes in dendrochronology, the use of tree rings to study environmental history and change. Evan, just yesterday on the morning show, we were talking about the record high water levels in Lake Superior, for example. We started keeping lake level data in the 1800s, but trees have been tracking it for much longer. What were you and your students able to glean from trees regarding this aspect?
Sure. And this is kind of one of the reasons that we do this, is to gain a deeper and deeper understanding of how these natural systems work. And so lake level variability, the lakes have always been changing in their level, but we need to understand, you know, what are the patterns, what are the long-term trends. And so if you look at what factors control how high the lakes are, it's how much rain falls over the lake and how much water either flows out or evaporates off. And if you start to parse those processes out, that can relate then to how hot was it? What was the relative humidity? How cloudy was it? And link those to the same processes. And so with something like hemlock, hot years tend to be associated with certain kind of weather patterns, which then are directly related to how much water is coming into that lake system. And so by kind of looking at these mechanistic links between what's the physiology of a tree and why does it grow, compared to what are the controlling mechanisms of some of these climatic systems, you can connect the dots and directly go between them.
The research you're conducting is with undergraduate students. Explain what the work looks like and how is this different from more traditional academic research?
Yeah, that's one of the pieces that we really love. UW-Platteville is almost entirely undergraduate students, and my colleagues in geography and I really celebrate research as a teaching tool, and it can be a profound and, we hope, transformative experience for some of our students. And so by taking an undergraduate research approach, it means that a lot of these projects take a lot longer to do than if we were, say, a research machine and that was our prime responsibility. But what it means is that as we take individual students and kind of piece together these larger projects, it'll span several years, but students who come in at the beginning are helping lay the foundation, and those students at the end are starting to kind of engage with some of the more complicated and complex analyses. And then when you see a student who gets in early and takes it all the way through, like our group that just finished on the Driftless Cedars project, to see them presenting at an international conference to world leaders in climate research and have people coming back again and again to their poster as they're explaining. I mean, it was so exciting.
It has to be a real rush for them.
Yes, and us.
Well, yeah, you too. But I mean, you know, the teacher is always proud to see the students succeed. But for them, what an experience they'll take away from that. The changing climate conditions can actually improve some species of trees. Why shouldn't we be thinking of this as a win?
Well, that's a really important aspect of this whole thing to think about. And this past fall, in a global vegetation class, I had a group of students that we called it the Fate of Species Project. And they looked at growth patterns of oaks in the Driftless, of red pine from Minnesota Point up near Superior in Duluth, and hemlock on the Apostle Islands. And we established how climate has been affecting those trees and then how climate is projected to change in the future. And then to predict if those trees will do better or worse. And in some cases, the trees are actually going to do better.
Okay.
But land use and people play such an important role in that stewardship.
And we're going to continue to talk about that in just a moment. Evan Larson is an associate professor of geography at UW-Platteville. He specializes in dendrochronology, the use of tree rings to study environmental history and change. When we come back, we will be talking about the changing climate and how it's impacting certain tree species with cultural significance for tribal nations. I'm John Munson, in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kate Archer Kent. We've been learning about what trees can tell us about our environment and climate today on the morning show with Evan Larson, associate professor of geography at UW-Platteville. As our conversation continues, we'll hear about how the changing climate is impacting certain tree species with cultural significance for tribal nations. Tehase Hill is chairman of the Oneida Nation. Chairman Hill, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you, John.
You're a member of the Oneida Nation. Tell us about the cultural significance of the black ash tree for your tribe.
Well, for us, we use black ash for basket weaving primarily. So we use it for different styles of baskets for storing, cleaning, and washing and hauling our white corn. It's also a very cultural significant food item. And so then we have currently a basket guild here in Oneida that are working to pass down the the trade of basket making itself. And so with the introduction of the emerald ash borer into the area, you know, it's got us questioning how we're going to continue with this traditional craft into the future if the tree's emerald ash borer takes out our available black ash trees. What are we doing? So there's other ideas of, well, can we harvest what we have now and safely store them? But that's only kind of prolonging the use of the ash tree and not very long into the future.
So how bad is the infestation of emerald ash borer where you are?
Well, we continue to monitor it. It's not every tree is affected right now, but that's definitely something that's on our radar to keep an eye on. We have monitoring stations, work with the APHIS and different departments to make sure we're monitoring and making sure that we have an idea of what's coming and trying to figure out what we can do about it.
Evan, where do these invasive species like emerald ash borer come from? What makes them invasive?
A lot of invasive species really have a huge impact because they're coming from a place where they have a set of natural predators, and then they're introduced to a place that they don't. And that kind of lets their population explode. And a lot of our trees don't have natural defenses. The emerald ash borer is just one example of many. You can look at elm, chestnut, hemlock, and we have a lot of really amazing and important species that are disappearing in a lot of places because of these things.
Is emerald ash borer an extreme example, or is the detriment it causes comparable to other invasive species affecting ecosystems across Wisconsin?
I think that it's just the current example. I think that nobody was here right now to see the chestnut disappear from eastern forests. That was an incredibly important plant. You know, some people may remember the almost complete loss of elms along our streets, but fewer people remember the loss of those trees in our forests. So it's dramatic, absolutely. I don't think it's out of the range of what we've experienced in the past.
Evan Larson is a geography professor who studies tree rings, among other things. Tehassee Hill is chairman of the United Nations. They're here to talk about trees and what they can teach us and what the dangers are as we lose species. Chairman Hill, the birch tree is significant to the Ojibwe Nation. Can you share a little bit about why that is?
Yes. I think very similar to the ash tree, they also use this kind of cultural items, basket making and artwork, and then also couple different species of the birch are also significant medicines for treating different ailments. So, you know, there's a lot of uses for a lot of these different trees, and it's a big detriment to, I think, our native populations and the ecosystem itself. You know, every time we lose a species, we don't know entirely all the uses for that particular plant or tree, or and so it's a loss to the human community as well every time we lose a species.
The birch tree is being affected by climate change in different ways. What changes are we seeing for Wisconsin's birch tree population, Chairman Hill?
I think it's from what I understand, that the birch tree is more of a it likes the cooler temperatures, and so as the temperatures start to rise, the birch tree is kind of receding back north, you know, and so that has the effect of essentially potentially lose the birch trees in the state of Wisconsin if we continue to have this warming trend.
Evan, is Wisconsin at risk of losing tree species due to increasing temperatures, or is it more complex than that?
Well, this goes back to your question about, you know, is it a win or a loss, because southern species do better when they have warmer winter temperatures and the warmer conditions generally, and we're getting wetter too. Birch trees will lose in the scenarios that are painted out by climate change models, because those hot summer temperatures will stress them out, and that's a really important component of northern systems. And so change is really the emphasis here, is that we are at a point of unprecedented change in how our system and land is functioning, and that has a direct relationship to who we are as people and culture and how we think of this place.
Chairman Hill, what changes do you think we need to make in the way we manage and in the way we understand and even the way we think about our forests?
I think it's important that we continue to monitor nature, I guess, in its own habitat. You know, these systems were essentially designed through, you know, nature itself to be able to survive and thrive. And these systems, you know, our natural systems are all connected, and we're connected into that system as well. And so when we're starting to lose parts of our natural system, you know, that's in the long term, that's going to affect the human population. So I think it's important that we keep an eye on these things and do our best to manage as best as possible. I know earlier in the show you talked about, you know, the use of fire and how that has changed, you know, over the decades or centuries of kind of forest management as well. So I think there's a lot of practices out there that need to really investigate and try to make them a safer, I guess, option to bring those types of things back to help manage our forests.
And maybe even just raise people's awareness of what the forest is. I mean, we think of them as static places, and they don't change because we can't see the changes. But they're changing all the time, aren't they, Evan?
Yeah, and this is one of the most powerful things that trees do, is that they expand our temporal perspective. Because the birch trees are being affected by warming temperatures, absolutely. But they're also this legacy from when so much of Wisconsin was logged and cut. And burned in slash fires. And so a lot of these trees, they're getting old anyway. And it's really important to recognize that we have we've had a tremendous impact on the system. And it's important that we see ourselves and the role that we play moving forward.
Well, we do. Everything we do affects our environment. What message would you like to give listeners about understanding and sustaining our region's forests?
I think that the long history that people share with the forests of this region are really important to recognize, and that things like climate change and logging and all these actions that we are driving are impacting our system, and that we bear a responsibility to contemplate our role in that and what role we should play moving forward.
And as Chairman Hill pointed out, it affects all of us in the end, whether we understand it or not. Thanks to both of you for joining us this morning. Evan Larson, Associate Professor of Geography, UW-Platteville, specializing in dendrochronology, the use of trees to study environmental history and change. Thank you for being here this morning, Evan.
My pleasure.
Tehasi Hill is Chairman of the United Nations. Chairman Hill, thank you for sharing this time with us this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Glad I was able to participate.
Just ahead, are you using on-trend words? We'll find out together and learn how language trends emerge and grow in the first place. That'll be an interesting discussion. Find out how words become words. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.